Welcome to the Distraction Makers Podcast. I'm Gavin.
I'm Forrest.
I'm Tyler.
I'm Kevin.
On this episode, we're going to talk about the asymmetrical board game Root. Check it out.
You guys noticed how you get random people delivering boxes to your door now?
Amazon Flex.
Yeah, has that happened to you guys? I just had one from DHL, which is like a random dude who looked like Ted Bundy. He walks up to my door and he's like, "Hey, got a delivery?" And I'm like, "Sure, buddy." And
how do you know it was DHL?
He told me. He's like, DHL.
He didn't
got
have
delivery.
He didn't have a uniform.
He had
or anything
no on? Uniform. Looked like a normal.
He was probably going to kill you.
Looked like a serial killer.
I had a couple people like that.
Right.
Yeah. So like Amazon Flex is trying to be the Uber of home delivery,
right,
where you can just sign on to it. But somebody with Amazon Flex wouldn't identify themselves as DHL.
Right.
That's weird.
Yeah,
well,
and
DHL
he was driving.
Might be trying to do the same thing.
He was driving a regular vehicle too. It was just a regular old SUV.
I mean, if it works for pizza.
I thought it was like a neighbor or something that got my package by accident, but instead he just showed up and handed me.
I wonder if there's actually a shortage of trucks, because if there's more deliveries that need to be happening, maybe the trucks are reaching capacity, and so maybe this is how they're accounting for that.
Is there
because
also
they probably had to.
Is there also a shortage of uniforms?
Like that's yes.
<they're sick>. Yeah. they used all the uniforms to make. Listen, they've used all the uniforms up to make more masks. You know, because the mask shortage.
That's fair. Yeah, I mean that's just.
Or
smart.
they just stopped giving a shit, and they're like, why would people care? Are they going to return your package? Are they going to be like, no, come back with your uniform?
I would agree with what Tyler said that they're using the shirts to make masks, but this guy wasn't wearing a mask, so.
Mm.
Well,
God, he is a
I just
paradox.
I don't know what's going on, but I'm on to you,
what
Jeff Bezos.
What did he deliver you, give you?
Oh, like, it was a box from Japan or something. It was one of those
did you order
Japan
it?
Crates or something.
You need the COVID enhancement for your home security system where you can see them coming up and just spray bleach in their face.
There you go.
If they're not wearing a mask.
This is what Trump told me to do.
Spray bleach.
Please,
no, that's
please
injecting
ingest
it.
This. Yeah.
You need a syringe.
Please shoot this in your arm first, then I'll take the pen.
Yeah.
Any rate. All right, guys. You want to talk about Root?
No.
Wait, what?
That game we've been playing.
Is that what we're talking about? That's a game we've
been let's talk about Root, the asymmetrical board game.
We might want to discuss why we're even talking about Root.
Well, let's go over what Root is first, I think, right?
Well, I'm saying that we could at least tell people we played Root.
Well, of course. Why else would we talk about
it? Yesterday. I don't know. I'm just saying, like, it's not like we played this a month ago. Like, we played it yesterday.
Okay.
All together.
Right. So we've been playing Root. Before we get too into specifics here, let's talk about the general terms of what the game is. let's give a little bit of a primer into what the game is. It's an asymmetrical board control game, I suppose you would call it, right? It's similar to like Risk.
It's
in
a
that
Euro
fashion.
Style.
Euro
so
style board
the,
control game.
I watched the interview with the designer, and he said
the GDC
he
one.
Just yeah, no, I don't know.
The interview is with heavy cardboard.
Oh. Yeah, but he calls it a war game. He says it's
okay.
Literally
yeah,
a war game.
I buy that, especially after watching his GDC talk. It's designed by Cole Worley. And he designed it for Leader Games in St. Paul, Minnesota, and it's interesting. It's I guess what's funny is so the reason why we played it is because it's on Steam. It has a digital, an actual digital version. It's not like a weird tabletop simulator version of the game, which we did look at as well. But the actual Steam version of it is pretty good. It in comparison to other digital board game ports that we've played.
Right. I don't even want to complain about it.
That's a whole nother level of
that's a whole nother episode
nonsense.
I think we'll have I'm going to write that.
but yeah, their Steam version's really pretty good. It's pretty spot on. I hesitate to say whether or not I would play this game had I bought it in tabletop form, There's a lot going on, and so by asymmetrical four-player game, it basically means that there are four different factions in this game, and each of them play completely different from the others. They use the same board, they use some of the same mechanics, but all of them approach them in different ways. Like all of them, say, can fight each other, for instance, but the way that the Vagabond and the Marquita Cat fight each other or interact in combat is totally different, where like the cats have buildings that can be destroyed, they also have soldiers that can be destroyed, but the Vagabond is just a single character who collects items, and so when he gets hurt in combat, he loses the use of some of his items for a while until he repairs them. So I guess the biggest thing I want to say about this game is it's kind of a marvel that all of these systems, all of these different ways of approaching the same layout or the same sort of gameplay.
Shared elements.
How these gears somehow work together is a very tightly wound, well-designed system.
That's what interested me in playing it at first, that I'm not usually the kind to like Euros and war games, but the idea of an asymmetrical game where each one plays entirely differently gets at that same itch that like has been really taking off in games lately, like MOBAs and Overwatch and such, where it's like you're seeing the same map in a completely different way based on who you play.
Well, the thing that's actually really interesting is, yeah, and I'm watching his Cole's GDC talk, and he's basically bringing up the fact that he thinks this type of game that video games are very bad at. And I'm like, oh, how interesting. He's talking about the ones that he thinks do it best, or at least can kind of tell a similar type of story, are things like PUBG, right? PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, where it's this big war zone, or what, and you sort of end up making your own stories, and different characters have different weapons and things that are going to approach these situations differently. And I'm like, oh, that's really, like, watching this GDC talk is like kind of, it wasn't exactly the way that I would think going into this design, and I found it quite fascinating.
Yeah, I think we need to explain too that the GDC talk was primarily talking about the the term is called kingmaking aspect of the game.
Yeah, well, I was going to bring
kingmaking games.
Yeah, that's a good segue into kingmaking and kind of the contentiousness of kingmaking games. And
can we explain kingmaking?
Because
I hadn't heard of it until today.
Right. So my understanding, kingmaking basically means that you might not be able to win the game, but you can do something that will pick who will be the winner of the game. And a lot of times this is considered bad design, in that you want everything to be fair at all times. And then, yeah, this is really the crux of what Cole is getting at in his GDC talk, is he's purposefully designed Root to be a kingmaking game because he's a fan of kingmaking games. He even goes into the history of games and talks about, like, I mean, even just history in general, and talking about how the idea of us wanting our games to be fair is flawed because life is not fair. And if you're trying to tell a really dynamic, interesting story, the way you're going to do that is through unbalanced gameplay, essentially. It's through this idea of kingmaking, which is,
I was just gonna say like, listening to the GDC talk, like, I really recommend, like, anyone that's interested in this stuff, like Tyler, Kevin, I don't know if you guys listened to it or not. Did you guys listen to it?
Okay. Not yet.
Yeah. He gets into some super interesting discussions as far as like talking about game design outside of the actual gameplay itself and the social dynamics that make up a kingmaking game. And that, like, and there's something that he talked about in the talk that actually resonated with me after our last playthrough, and that at the end of that playthrough, the one thing I took away was, I am not gonna let the Woodland Alliance beat me next time.
Right. Right. But you're gonna kill
that.
Yeah,
that was my takeaway of the first game I played too.
Right. And that is a social response to the game design that he's created.
Yeah.
And that, like, we can look at that, and on paper, as designers, I think all of us feel very similarly about the design of games and how we make them. And on paper, all of us, I think collectively, probably would have been like, no, why would we make a game that, like, almost, it's a for sure thing, the Woodland Alliance will probably win, like, every first game you play. But that, I think the way he's viewing it is like, yeah, if they win, people will then know, don't let them win. Like, don't let them do this thing.
That's why I was saying when we were playing last night, I was like, yeah, you gotta snuff the rebellion before it starts.
Yeah.
And that's like kind of the purpose of it, I guess.
The thing that I think was interesting when he's, the problem that I had, honestly, when we were playing last night was, okay, so I've played a few times before we played this game, and I'd played the Eerie, which are the birds, more than, like, basically, I've only played them. There's been, like, one or two other games where I've played other factions, but I've been playing the birds the whole time, and I had set myself up in a way that was like, okay, I'm firing on all cylinders here. I haven't gone into turmoil, which is basically you can screw something up, and then you have to switch leaders, and a bunch of bad stuff happens. You kind of, like, reset if you screw something up. So I hadn't screwed up anything yet the whole game. And then there was one turn where Tyler had an opportunity to kill five of my troops with no consequences to himself, and that lost me the game, straight up. Mm-hmm. Like, one action by another player was able to ruin the game for me.
And that was a dominance card, right? That's what it
technically was? No. I'm not even talking about that.
It's a card. It's just a crafted card. The thing with that is it's kind of a Stars Align moment, honestly.
No. He's talking about when you built a base.
Right. This is a normal...
That flipped five of his dudes.
Yeah, this is normal game mechanics that you can do at any time.
That wasn't...
Not the big play, though.
Right, but that was later. And that, like, just solidified that, like, nobody else was going to win or whatever. But, yeah. But my point being that, like, it would have been a much closer game leading up to the end of the game had this one thing not happened. And don't get me wrong, I could have made sure that, like, okay, I shouldn't have had my soldiers there or whatever. But the ability to swing that far in one action, and he, let's say that, you know, Tyler was playing the Woodland Alliance. If he hadn't been in that position to do that, or he wasn't in the position to win later, and he does this action, it's going to keep me from winning. It's going to make somebody else win, which is sort of the whole king-making thing, right?
So mechanics like this. Well, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, Cole's defense of the king-making design philosophy, I guess I should say, is that it makes much more interesting stories. And that's really the thing that I want to talk about, is do we think king-making makes better stories?
Well, I have a connection there to why this is, I think, viscerally fun, even though as a mechanic it may seem counterintuitive. So in a king-making game, there are big swings that happen, and then in our game especially, there was a dynamic shift where we went from each pursuing our own goals to saying, okay, this guy's got to go down somewhere around the two-thirds mark.
It happened earlier than even you guys know. Kevin and I were talking privately, like, pretty early on.
Okay, that's fine.
That was taking you guys out.
Like, good, you said, that was a function of the fact that Woodland Alliance won the last game I played, and this game, I had sympathy for Forrest, who was new and playing the faction that I played last time, and so I'm like, all right, Forrest, I'm going to try to not let you lose to Woodland Alliance. That's my goal here. Because that's what... But anyway, back to what I was saying, that a take-that system in games has a very similar dynamic shift where something happens and you're about to go down. And of course, the last thing you think is, okay, who can I take with me? What can I do to swing things in a spiteful way? Because that's fun, right? Mm-hmm, and it also adds some consequence to ruining a player. So, like, when Tyler... ruined your day and swung the game. Since your strategy was no longer about winning, it created a whole new story for the game. And even if you're of the design sensibilities that we are, that we want a game to have this clear narrative through line and all mechanics should be fun, that's still fun in a counterintuitive way to have this design shift and then have this goal shift from winning to taking you down.
Yeah, and I do think that it creates, potentially creates more memorable moments that's like, oh, remember, like, I got screwed over, and then I was able to take you down. I couldn't win, but at least I could stop you from winning. You know what I mean?
And that outlives the joy of victory in many games.
Potentially, yeah.
It's an interesting, like, idea because, or at least for the idea of, or the philosophy of king-making games, I've never really heard that term or thought about that before, but... It started making me think about, like, who's the actual winner of a game? Like, is there, Like, when you play a game, is there just always one winner? Or if you help somebody else win, you kind of also win mm-hmm. with them socially. Like, it's mm-hmm. not mm-hmm. like board games, especially since it's not cut and dry. Like there's just, you know, one winner, whatever. It's like a chess or whatever. There's clearly one winner. But when in a group game like this, when alliances can be made just through the mechanics of the game, who wins doesn't really matter. It's how you affect the outcome of the game.
Right.
In our game, if Forrest had won, I would have felt more victorious.
I was about to say that if I think back on it and I think about any time that I've played a game and I've helped someone else win, I don't think I felt bad because I didn't win. I think I felt mm-hmm. really good because this is what I think is extra funny about it, is I wouldn't think to cater to the feelings of pettiness and spite. Mm-hmm. Right? Because I wouldn't see that as like, oh, this is a good quality I want to encourage. Right. Even though I like that. I love that in games. I love being spiteful or petty or whatever in games. Like, to me, that is fun to do that. I do think it's a big characteristic of assassin archetype players. And I do think that is probably, I'd say like assassin archetype and mastery in games, those two things are very like,
sure. Yeah.
Like in tune with one another, which would explain why players like this type of game like that. Mm-hmm. But I do think it is super interesting that like it is still satisfying even if you don't win. It's satisfying if you overthrow someone.
Well, it's almost like looking at the spider in Game of Thrones or whatever, the guy who's like he's behind the scenes and he's got his hands and everything and he's not gonna be the king, but he gets to basically pick who is gonna
is
be
called
it
called the spider.
What? Yeah, I thought it was the spider. Am I wrong?
I think I remember that
Varys?
Too.
Varys. Yeah, Varys. Yeah.
The bald guy?
It's like how Littlefinger is called Littlefinger. It's like his version.
Okay.
He doesn't get called that often in the show, I don't think. But is that his name? Is he the spider? Am I crazy?
I mean, Varys for sure.
There is a character
is
with that moniker in Game of Thrones. Right. I don't recall though.
Varys. Anyway, it feels like that's kind of what you're asking players to be in this game, but you're not doing it directly, which is interesting. The other thing that I will say is that without the digital version of this game, I don't know if I would have gotten through the rule book. I feel like I'm becoming notorious for this, though. Like, I will pick up a game, I will open the rule book to read it and learn how to play it, and I will bounce off so hard if, like, the rules aren't simple enough for me to just get in the game and start playing. Like, if there's a ton of setup, if there's a ton of, you know, weird rules that I need to remember that like are exceptions, for instance, or sometimes as we call it, band-aids. If there's a lot of that stuff, I bounce off games pretty hard. So I do wonder if I would have gotten the tabletop version of this game, would I be able to push through and learn all these systems and learn all these things without a digital version? What do you guys think?
I think it has one major thing going for it in that department, that it turns the setup itself, part of it, into gameplay. The part where the cat begins by choosing their keep and their starting layout is a tactical choice that is part of the gameplay. And so rather than just laying out your pieces in the beginning, it turns that into the phase one or the first act, which offloads a bunch of it. It feels like you've just jumped in and started playing, even though you're still kind of doing the setup. But as far as the enormity of the rules, that is, for a certain type of player. I think there's a big audience for that, and it just may or may not be to our taste.
Well, listening to his GDC talk, he talks about how Twilight Imperium and like these really big grand strategy board games are some of his, like, the stuff that he likes to play. Mm. And then you look at Root and you're like, oh, this is like, when you compare it to Twilight Imperium or whatever, this is much more simple. But when you compare it to,
like,
Uno,
we talked about Scythe. We talked about
we're not playing Scythe Force.
I know. I'm just saying that, like, I think it's on like a similar comprehension level to Scythe.
Well, yeah, and I think what's interesting is he talks about it as an entry point to war games almost, right? He not
I can see that.
I don't think he means it like war games like Warhammer. I think he means it more like Twilight Imperium. Mm-hmm. And like mm-hmm. this is an introduction to that genre of game, and I would agree with that.
The game I keep thinking about is Diplomacy when I think about this kind of game.
Remind me of Diplomacy. I think I've
Diplomacy.
Played it,
I've only played it once, I think. But you're in Europe. It's I believe World War One based, but you basically have your armies or your territory, and you pick your actions secretly from everybody. So it's not turn by turn. It's everybody picks what they're doing hidden. But there's a moment before you do that where you start conversing and making truces, and like you're trying to convince people to be on your side, and you'll make promises about like, no, I won't attack this if you don't attack here. And then after that period is done, then everybody writes down what their actions are going to be. And then it happens. Then everybody flips them over, and then you just I think at that point it's kind of turn by turn of like
who resolution gets order
to resolution order. Yeah. But it's the same kind of I guess like discussion of like when they're getting way too strong over there. We need to come together to like fight this person, and then whoever wins doesn't matter, because as long as that person loses, that's a triumph.
So it's almost like you're playing a game of Commander Magic, where like you want to stay under the radar as much as possible until you can just somehow have this unstoppable machine that just wins and nobody saw you coming. You know, like you don't want to be aggressive early because people are going to target you. You know, there's sort of those table dynamics, right?
So, I mean, a little easier to do in Magic, though, because you don't have the victory point score there telling everybody how far along you are.
It's very true, especially because that victory point score can be very deceiving in Root, where it looks like, oh, I might be up early in the game. I'm at like 11 points or whatever, and everybody else is at like 7, and you're, oh, man, he's in the lead. But I'm just slowly getting like 3 points a turn or whatever, and then you look at this other faction that can get 12 points in one turn. And swing and suddenly be way in the lead.
I wonder if in the design process, if they thought about like how, like I think the Aries are more consistent point earners, right?
That's what it seems.
Then you
like.
Have the and then you have the big swing factions, and then you have the more war conquering factions and stuff like that. So I wonder if that. I think we've talked about like, man, we just want to. I just want to see more interviews with the designers and like actually hear what the design process is.
We talked about this last night after playing, because like it's something that I find is so interesting listening to Cole discuss designing this game and discuss his own philosophies on design. And one thing I thought was incredibly funny, but I understand where it's coming from, is in the interview he did with Heavy Cardboard, he said how much he cares about accessibility in games. Mm-hmm. And I was like, but but it's accessibility in the Twilight Imperium genre, right? In that heavy, more convoluted genre, his game probably is more accessible. But when we collectively look at accessibility, we look at like, how quickly, literally within seconds or minutes, can people start playing this game? Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, as opposed to Twilight Imperium, where it's like, let's read the rule book for 2 hours, or Root, where it's like, let's take 30 to 45 minutes to read it.
Yes, yeah.
And that everybody pick a character, learn how to play that character, and then we'll actually play a game.
Right, and that's what's kind of interesting about Root, too, is there's a whole lot of complexity there, because there's four factions that play totally differently. So you have to basically learn all of them, or you're not going to even understand what you can do to stop someone else from winning.
Then let's shuffle the teams and spend 30 minutes reading the rule book again.
Right. But that is something to bring up, though, is that like it's almost a given that, at least in my case, let's see, it was my first time playing the Cats. It was my first time playing the game in general. Kevin, it was your first time last night playing the Vagabond, correct?
Yes, correct.
And so that, I think, that like first game or the first game of people being a little inexperienced in factions, like I think that's just a given that there's going to be hiccups there, especially with my first game. Now going into it, I still don't know how to play the Vagabond or the Eerie or the Woodland Alliance, right. But I generally can see on the board what makes them stronger or weaker. And so now I'll be able to kind of push against that.
It's an interesting, right. Like, natural way to have replayability,
yeah.
Without just having like random stuff or organization or different mm-hmm. setups and stuff like that. It's like you have to keep playing because you need to know, you need to like figure out how the other factions, you know, operate. And that every time you play, you're going to learn more and more and more about it, like how to defend against it, how should you expand your territory, how should you, you know, how everything interacts with each other.
I was talking to my wife about this earlier, and I was saying that, like, what seems really interesting about Root is it seems like one of those games that, like, I would not be able to play this game with strangers. Because especially with how heavy the mechanics, I think, rely on that social dynamic and that communication. Like, imagine playing this game with people you know nothing about and you probably wouldn't want to be a dick to. And I'm not saying that most people are playing games with strangers, although that is becoming kind of more popular with COVID. But I was comparing it to, like, Secret Hitler. Secret Hitler would be a terrible game to play with random people. Like, to the point where it wouldn't be a fun game at all, I don't think.
Well, yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
You also, you'd have a much harder time trying to read people, I think. Like, you don't know them. You don't have any way to discern whether or not they're lying, unless they're just really bad at it.
And there's no motivation. The motivation in any of these games is social clout, in a way. It's social, like having fun spiting a friend. Even, not even for anything in the game. You can, and this is what I liked about... I watched a video earlier today on depth versus complexity, which we kind of talked about last night, and I think we could probably get into, especially using this game as a kickoff point. But one thing that video brought up was that they viewed engagement actually as more important than I guess like depth in general, is like how quickly can you engage and how much can you engage the player in what you're doing, even if there isn't a lot of depth to it. Are you entertained doing this thing? And I personally agree with that. But one thing I did think about when I was thinking about this game, and I think Cole maybe even mentioned it in his GDC talk or the interview, was that that is why the cats start out the way they start out. Mm-hmm. Because if the goal of the game is to create that sort of like, hey, why did you do that to me? Thing, well, it happens immediately if everywhere there's a cat and you guys decide where there's a threat to my cats.
Well, I think that there's multiple places where he does this. He does it with the cats, like you're saying, in the setup, but he also does it with the birds, in that there's actions the bird player has to take every turn, and if they don't take that action, they fall into turmoil, right? Which means if my bird says I have to attack every turn, sorry. Gotta attack.
And that's going to be a cat that you're attacking. Right. So to clarify, the cats begin with a very tenuous hold on the entire board at the beginning, and the birds start with much faster troop production and very little land. So the natural flow of the game is going to be aggressive expansion of the birds right off the bat.
Which pushes everyone, onto the cats.
Everyone except for the Vagabond has to in some way take away from cats in order to do anything in the beginning. And yeah, you're right. That's a very intentional way to introduce people to the taking away from another player. You never start the game with a safe point where you can do something that doesn't hurt someone else. And I think that's very good design.
So being somebody who loves the birds so much, I worry that they are the easy target in this king-making problem.
It's easy to make them lose.
Not only is it easy to make them lose, it's also... they're easily targeted as the one who comes out ahead first, because you start with three actions. You could have four, depending on... Okay, so when the birds start, you have this thing called your decree, which is you have four different leaders to choose from. The leader that you choose has two spots already on the decree for you, depending on the leader. So the first one that I almost always pick is the one that can have my troops move and can build another roost, which gives me more... Each roost gives me more victory points. So I choose this one. And then at the start of my turn, I get to use cards in my hand and add those to my decree, which then makes me have more things that I can do, which is like, okay, the decrees are recruit, which gets you more troops. You can move, you can attack, and you can build. And so if I put one of my cards from my hand under move, I now have the move from my leader, who's already on my sheet, and then I have another required move on my sheet now. So I have to move twice, and I have to build once. I could play an additional card on my decree if I wanted to, but you have to play at least one every turn. You can play one to two each turn. And the other thing that you have to do is they have to match the suits of the cards, right? So this is probably getting too confusing to try to explain just with audio.
Without context.
But you have suits of cards, which then gives you an additional requirement if you play one of those to your decree. That means it has to happen at a certain location. So not only do I have to move twice, one of those moves has to be at a specific location. So if I don't have any troops in that location to move, then I fall into turmoil, which means I lose points, I lose victory points, and I have to start all over from ground zero. And this decree just keeps building every turn. You're like this machine that, like, and this is one of the ways that Colt describes it, is you're basically playing a programming kind of game where you have to look at, like, this is my input, this is my output, what am I going to need for this turn and the next turn and the next turn? You're thinking turns and turns ahead. And if you can keep if you can keep that thing on the tracks, you're going to be very powerful very quickly, which I think puts a big target on your head. But then once you get knocked back to square one, you have to build your way back up.
Mm-hmm. And so we discussed how.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I'm just saying, I think this makes birds an easy target. Is that, you're going to look more powerful early. But anyway, go ahead.
So we discussed how the cat start encourages people to interact right from the get go. And I actually thought there's interesting teaching in the replayability where the game will, the Woodland Alliance generally wins the first game, and then there's the social dynamic.
I don't think the Woodland Alliance wins the first game necessarily.
Not a guarantee.
Well, that's been my experience, so that could be. But there seems to be a gravity, like, in the direction of the flow of the game. But I guess my point was, the second game, the social currency goes, okay, how do we stop that guy from winning? And then you slowly have to learn how to get each player, like, you learn how to make you win, but you also have to learn how to make each enemy lose.
So does it become just a game of chasing the last person to win? Like, okay, well, what Alliance won, let's make sure they don't win again.
But what I'm observing from what you're saying is that the birds are an interesting entry point in learning how to make other players lose. Because if I'm Marquis de Cat, I start with the most troops, and I'm like, oh, this looks great. The birds are in this tiny little corner, and they expand so quickly, and they take so much of my territory mm-hmm. and endanger my ability to win so immediately that my first goal as the cats is to figure out how to make birds lose. Right after I figure out how to make me get points, I need to figure out how to make them lose points. And so it's a nice learning curve there. And then once you focus on making the birds lose, Woodland Alliance probably wins because nobody focused on them. So then you've got your next game. Okay, we all now need to figure out how to learn that faction.
So this is what I don't necessarily like about this type of design. And again, it very well could be lack of experience of playing this game. I feel like this is one of those type of games that, like, you do need to play hours and hours and hours. You need to have other people that have played hours and hours and hours so that collectively all of you can kind of be on this level playing field when you actually dive into the game.
But do you want to? Do you want to play those hours?
I don't know if I want to play those hours. I had a nice time playing with you guys, and it did pique my curiosity enough where I was like, okay, I kind of want to play again. I want to see, like, what we could do differently. And I'm curious how the other factions play. Definitely piqued my curiosity enough.
But then he started playing Battlegrounds.
And then I started playing Hearthstone Battlegrounds instead, which has...
The story of your gaming life.
Just the easiest accessibility in the world. But anyway, what I don't necessarily care for the design, and I am curious to see if this is what happens with high-level players, is there someone that just gets pooped on? Like... Right. Because that's what I'm concerned about. I'm just concerned that, like, someone's going to play the birds or someone's going to play Woodland Alliance and everyone's going to know, like, oh, well, let's just go for them. Like, just go for them and then we'll all try and get, like, big. But then I don't know if that happens because what if in going for them, let's say everyone goes for the Woodland Alliance, okay? Mm-hmm. But in doing so, the birds start getting ahead
Right.
And so if the birds get ahead, then, well, at some point, you know, the vagabond and the cat maybe have to work together and they have to push back on the birds. And so, like I think that could happen, but I just don't know. You know, I don't know how that must feel for the player that immediately gets put it on the chopping block.
Does it ever reach an actual point of equilibrium where it's all
sort of that's where the kingmaking comes in.
Right. Where is it always mutually, like, do you reach a point of mutually assured destruction where if you decide, all right, I'm going to go try to take these guys out, but by doing that, I'm making, that's the kingmaking part of it.
Right. I'm wondering at high level play, is there a faction that someone just really doesn't want to play because they know everyone's going to go after them? Like,
I'm curious. I kind of wonder if it's the birds, because
see, and I would say it's Woodland Alliance. I think it's Woodland Alliance. Most players that I saw online that were talking about the game said that, like, inexperienced players almost 100% of the time lose to Woodland Alliance, but then high level players know, well, just keep them in check and they won't win. And it's like, but then what about the player that's playing them? They're probably having a terrible time.
Well, yeah, that's one of those. The game has a learning curve from game to game, because, like, to a newer player, the Woodland Alliance has costs associated with attacking them or doing anything to inconvenience them. You have to give them cards pretty much every time you move into their territory or attack them for most factions. Mm-hmm. And so to a new player, they're like, oh, well, it's much easier for me to pick on the cats or the birds. So you do that, and you don't realize that if you let the Woodland Alliance get out of hand, they're going to win faster than you are.
Yeah.
So then as the learning curve grows, you learn to just, oh, keep them in check. I don't have the experience with the game to know how easy that is, though. And that's part of why I want to keep playing.
I know.
Like, I want to see the strategies evolve.
Yeah, it's like, I guess, like, the idea of discarding cards in your hand is, I think, scary to any player.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder if, like, you know, that's why the higher level play, it's like, yeah, your cards in your hand for other factions aren't as important as you might think.
Right.
So, like, I wonder if that's part of the learning curve at the beginning, is like, oh, I have to give you a card every time I do something? Ugh.
Well, but, like, players always want to play their cards. They don't want to discard.
Yeah, but, like, honestly, like, a lot of the factions don't really utilize the cards at all.
It's true, yeah.
It's only the Vagabond really does, or really wants to, or wants people to utilize them. But as far as we've played, we've never really used them to craft anything. And the only ones that are, like, useful that we want to keep are the ambushes. That's kind of all the
only armorer,
ones.
Like the really salient combat ones.
Yeah, yeah. Because all the other ones are combat-based. But then you have the victory point cards that you can craft. But they just kind of give an option to
the Vagabond.
The Vagabond.
That kind of helps, though, with your analysis on your turn, deciding when you need to discard. There are some that you're like, well, I don't even understand how or when I'd use that. And it's clear because it's for a different faction. Like, that's what that ability is for. So you are more okay discarding that and keeping the other. So that might even be a benefit.
And going back to our game when we played last night, when I had the one card that kind of just decimated the entire board, that card is so hard to get. Like, it just kind of, the stars just kind of align to activate that card. Right. I would, in most cases, have discarded that card because I'd be like, oh, that's almost
never
impossible. I have to have, There's only four rabbit spaces. I need to control three of them on my turn to craft it.
I don't think I'd put a card like that in a game, but when you look at the design philosophy from the designer's interviews, that you want good stories and you want emergent gameplay, you can see where a big moment card like that stands out.
You want those big swings that's just like, whoa, just, you know, blew the whole thing out of the water and changed the whole landscape of the rest of the game.
But I guess this is also, I don't know. The one thing that I'm very, very curious about is, like, having a card like that is random, takes a lot of setup, but generally the feeling that I get with this game, and it's what we got into last night, and it's still, I've been racking my brain with it all day thinking about it, is when does complexity overshadow depth of a game?
Mm-hmm.
Because the thing that I can't get over with this game is, does it need to be this way, to have the same amount of depth. And I'm not saying it can't have asymmetrical design. I'm not necessarily like a proponent of it. Like, I don't know enough about the asymmetrical Kingmaker type design. Like, I haven't played enough of those games. And hearing the interview with Cole, like, it felt like this whole other aspect of game design opened up to me, where I'm like, oh, shoot, like, this is so interesting hearing the game design through this lens and through this perspective. Like, there's definitely something here. And I think that's super interesting. But at the same time, can a game have this same level of depth without having four factions that play completely differently? And it, like we said, to me, it really does feel like you need to play several hours, several rounds of this game, and ideally with people that have also played several hours and several rounds of this game. Maybe not the same people, but people in general that have played it enough times. And does it need to be that in order to have that like real level of depth?
So that feels like a negative to you.
It feels like a negative to me to have this much complexity, because if I play this game a lot and I really like it, the learning curve or the bar that's set for me to try and show it to other people is set so high that, like, the people that, you know, will play it with me, like, great, but I know from seeing friends opening boxes of Scythe, or, you know, like whenever I see anyone playing Twilight Imperium, I'm not the type of guy to get excited about all these things. I'm like, God, I just want to play a game. Like, I want to play a game and I want to have fun. I think we can have fun, but it sucks that I have to spend 2 hours before I can maybe have fun. You know,
that's because you're a filthy casual.
I know, I'm a filthy, filthy casual. I'm dirty and I don't take showers. But listen, all right.
I mean, I understand. I understand where you come from. You want that easy access game. You want you can open the box, play right away.
I don't even know what this game is for. I don't know if I'd say easy access. Sorry, I just don't know if I'd say easy access, because like, what bothered me throughout this game is like, by the end of it, I maybe only figured out a quarter of it. And that's because I played my faction, right?
Right.
And then, but even then, I didn't play my faction the best. So I still have to learn how to really, really play my faction. So really, I only learned like 15% of the game, which is kind of exciting, but also really, really daunting. And I'm not promised that once I learn that 100% of the game, that I'm going to have a great time with it.
I was thinking about this a lot too, because we sort of brought it up as a primer before the episode. But I've been thinking about this a lot too, and the games that come to mind immediately for me are comparing chess and checkers, and then also comparing those to Go. And you look at chess and checkers, right? It's like, okay, well, checkers, stupid simple, right? This is one of the first games that many of us learn how to play. It's
a literal baby's game.
It's a baby's game, but
it's a baby's game.
There is depth and strategy to checkers. Like, there are things that you have to learn, and you make sure that you're okay. If I move here, then this is what's going to happen next, and you know, you're thinking turns ahead. And then it's like, okay, well, what about chess? Okay, well, chess, now you have to learn how each of the pieces move, and you're still thinking in a similar way that you do to checkers, where I need to think steps ahead. But now there's a whole lot more complexity, right? Does chess arguably have more strategy than checkers? I think yes.
Right.
Okay, so now let's talk about Go.
Mm-hmm.
Where Go has one thing that you can do on your turn. You place one token.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. But the strategy level of that game is infinite. I think the skill ceiling of Go is much higher than chess, where chess would be won by a computer.
I watched the Shut Up and Go... or Shut Up and Sit Down, like, episode on Go, and that one, it's so interesting, because I knew of Go, I understood how it played, but I never actually, like, looked at it, and it's, like, it's kind of like where you just said, Forrest, with, like, you might know 15% of the game, so in the Go episode, he said they recommend players start with, like, a smaller board. Mm-hmm. To kind of get you, like, understanding the mechanics and the strategy. And then that's only like 10% of the game.
Yeah.
Because then you expand it out and it changes the landscape completely. Right. And then you keep expanding it to the full board and it's a whole different like so game.
I think really, you know, by me bringing up these three games, I'm trying to illustrate that like you can create a massively strategic depth filled game with very little complexity.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, I mean, this is something that's kind of interesting too, because it's like, I think that the board game geek crowd in general values complexity too much. And I don't want to get too critical, because I agree with, like, the board games should have a lot of things going on, especially if you're going to be paying a lot of money for them. But there's this idea that, there's a dog barking outside. Great. there's this idea that, like, the bigger a box is, the better the game is, the more strategies packed into this box. And it's like, I don't think that's really the case here. And
I think, sorry, finish your thought.
Well, I was just going to also bring up Magic a little bit, because Magic is kind of, it is a hard game to learn. There's a barrier there. And it's another game, though, that's like infinitely complex and infinitely deep strategy-wise. But like, where does that fit, I suppose, in the spectrum of games? Like, go ahead.
This is where I feel like there needs to be solid definitions for what we're talking about here. Because to me, I view Magic as, honestly, I'd view it as a low to medium complexity, but high depth. And I actually saw this thread on Board Game Geek, which I think defined things really well, in that if you were able to break every game down into either low, mid, or high complexity, and low, mid, or high depth. Complexity being moving pieces, separate, strange, odd rulings, etc. Yep. Like, there's plenty of games that are like that. Magic, I don't think, is complex because, and we talked about this last night, I think that Magic, generally, it has its systems in place. You can learn those systems. It doesn't mean you're good at the game. That's where the depth comes in. But at least you know, like, oh, this is my phase that I do this, and I tap mana, and I do that. And it's still a little, like, it can be a little complicated or daunting for someone that hasn't played too many games or board games in the past. But I'd say it's not ultimately complex in its systems, but the depth absolutely is there. And that's where I think we need to really make sure that we are all aligned on these definitions when using them.
Yeah, the thing I want to bring up at this point with Magic is that there's a way to learn the rules of how to play Magic to be able to just play the game, and you don't actually understand how the rules of the game work. I know that sounds crazy, but what I mean is, when I first learned how to play Magic, I didn't understand that you had two main phases. Like,
you always want to do things the first one.
Right. Everybody at the beginning, when they first start playing, only does the first main phase. I don't know about everybody, but most people. And then, like, I didn't really understand how to master the game of Magic until I played Magic Online. And it actually took me through all of the phases of my turn, and I got to see how, at this point, damage went on the stack, and it doesn't do that anymore. But I saw, oh, I have damage on my creatures, and I have an opportunity to do something before they're actually dead. And, like, that was something most people didn't understand. And you start learning, like, oh, there's all these points where I get priority, therefore I can respond to something my opponent is doing. And I didn't even understand before that I could respond to them. So,
but I don't know if that really is adding too much complexity, really.
Ton of complexity.
I think adds complexity. No, really? I define complexity as the moving pieces.
Complexity as the ability to win a game with knowledge that other players don't have. Like, if I've played this game longer and I have mastery of the rules of the game, not the strategy of the game, I think that's complexity. I think that's a problem.
I'd define that as depth. Because the depth
that seems like what Forrest is defining.
What I'm saying is, if I can beat somebody because I know the rules of the game and you don't, I think that's complexity. Like, that's a problem. I shouldn't be able
to. But if you know how to use the rules advantage, that's
depth. What
I'm
saying is, let's look at Go. What are the rules? I can place one token every turn, right? Everybody can understand that.
Yeah, low complexity,
but
high depth.
The depth is in where I'm going to place it and why.
Mm-hmm.
If I take that comparison to Magic and I say, okay, well, I'm going to play cards during my second main phase, and you didn't understand that there was a second main phase, we're not playing the same game.
Right, but I'm saying that, honestly, I think that is lower complexity than we're giving credit for, and that I think you could tell anyone, like, for instance, let's tell anyone that has played a card game in the past, okay? Mm-hmm. And then suddenly they're bringing brought onto Yu-Gi-Oh, or not Yu-Gi-Oh. Onto, yes, Yu-Gi-Oh. We're transitioning.
All of a sudden, this hardball game.
onto Magic of the Gathering. Okay. And if you tell someone the phases, or you write the phases down, and you say what are the, it's upkeep, main phase, and then there's,
they can follow that trail.
Combat phase, main phase two, and then end phase.
Sort of, yeah. Basically. That's some of them. Yeah.
Okay, but I'd say like
without the steps,
you get that, and then there's reaction. So if someone does something on your turn during a phase, you can react. And I get that, like, it can get complex, but if you tell someone that, they might not understand exactly how complex that can get or the depth of that.
Oh man!
But those phases alone laid out, I'd say, are fairly simple and offer the much needed structure of the game. But I also think that you guys are looking at Magic from a different perspective. I'm looking at it as a filthy casual,
right.
And I'm like, yeah, I get Magic, but you guys really get it, but that's the depth difference, right? That's the mastery difference.
Well, this is where I'm saying that the rule complexity is such a problem, because you just described what you thought the rules of the game were, of Magic are, and that's...
Off the top of my head, okay?
Right. So, they're untap, upkeep, draw, main phase one, declare attackers, declare blockers, damage, main phase two, end step cleanup. Those are the actual phases of Magic.
Okay.
I think, like, the true complexity of Magic comes from all the card abilities that
this is what
intertwine
I'm saying.
With all that.
This
but,
is
yeah.
what I'm saying, though. I'm in agreement, is that the actual good strategic depth of Magic comes from the all of the different cards. But the problem is that the rule scaffolding of how you play those cards is too complex. And Wizards has actually made adjustments to make the steps of the game more simple. And this is why I'm sitting here going, they actually probably identify this as a problem, too.
Where would you guys categorize that, though, as far as complexity when it comes to comparing that? Maybe it's hard for you guys. I don't know if you guys are able to disconnect enough from that. Because for me, even if I don't know all those exact steps,
you can still play
like,
the game. Yeah.
I could still play the game. Mm. But where would you categorize that level of complexity as opposed to, you know, let's say Root, for instance. It's hard because we haven't done the tabletop version of Root, but even in the digital version of Root, there were things that happened that we didn't know why they were happening.
That's true.
And that's the most streamlined version of the game. And we went, why can't I?
we're all new enough that we don't really know how far the depth goes too. But I mean, I'd agree with you. Magic is probably medium to low complexity, extraordinarily high depth. And Root certainly seems to be a higher complexity than Magic, but I'm not sure it's apples to apples.
Right.
I don't think that saying this hasn't hit the depth to complexity curve of Magic is necessarily a criticism.
Right.
Right.
I'm just making sure that when moving forward in this discussion, though, that, I mean, it does sound like we're all aligned as far as what we feel like is the difference between complexity and depth. But the one thing that I do think is very interesting is that if you go on to, for instance, BoardGameGeek.com and you watch that thread that I was on that talks about complexity versus depth, people were talking about some games as like, this is low complexity. And I looked at it and I'm like, that's not Uno. That's not if there's three tiers, you got to count everything.
Yeah.
I mean, chutes and ladders. All right. That shit is basic and low. So what is the low complexity? Because it's not, you know, whatever they were saying.
Settlers
it was.
Of Catan.
Right.
That's
yeah.
not low. Yeah.
That's not low complexity.
That's medium. If that's medium, Magic is hard. Magic is in the high complexity.
No, I don't think so. It with the amount of, if Gloomhaven exists, Magic doesn't exist in the same stage as Gloomhaven.
I guess I need to factor in that you can play Magic without fully understanding the rules.
If you consider teenage you with your green deck to be playing Magic in any real sense,
are you calling me out?
It's medium complexity.
What are you doing here? All right. Look, my green deck
was
great.
It's that deck we all had. Okay.
He just called out like every casual.
Everybody. That's my Kavu deck.
What,
like,
big?
Yeah.
You guys don't think big green boys are good enough? Is that
no. Sorry to break this to you, man.
We talk about It's all about size, right?
Look, if you haven't had a green Hydra deck
you can't deal with my 8/8
or your worm deck.
You know what's funny though is this kind of starts to come full circle now with the way that Magic works. Is that early on you start in green and then you move on to, you know, like black or white
red.
Or then you eventually end up at blue and then you're like, oh, I'm so good at this game, I can control how to play whatever. But then there's another level after that, which is actually
you
just
start
playing
combining the colors. Oh no!
The next level is that you're just gonna play whatever's the best deck, no matter what the color is.
That's the thing with like designed games like that. I mean, it's the designers. They kind of create the. It almost feels staged in like, the deck designs. And like,
do you think the Magic designers know what the best deck general strategy is going to be when they launch a set?
I think they have an inkling. They don't know what the final deck recipe is going to be, but they create
the
cards to create the. I mean, Hearthstone does the same thing. It's just they create these cards. They're like, this is going to be probably the next big.
And
the next Tarmogoyf.
The times when things are broken, when they get cards that get banned, that's when they didn't understand what the top deck was.
Skull Clamp.
It's so funny to bring up Skull Clamp because there's been so many more broken things since.
That was the last one. Listen, I haven't played since Skull Clamp.
Oh my god, so you haven't played in like 15 years? Like,
no, I haven't played since 2008.
So fun. Quick funny story about the development of Skull Clamp is that Skull Clamp originally was giving a creature +1/+1, not +1/-1. And then at the very, like, right before they printed it, they were like, nah, +1/+1 is too good. It should be +1/-1. And that's what broke the card completely.
Yeah.
It's hilarious. Yeah, it's really weird.
That's a change.
It's like, oh, I can make a lot of 1/1 tokens, just kill them all off. Oh,
yeah,
okay, cool.
Yeah.
You can do that with something in Hearthstone. But Magic does not have the ability
have
to be that unforgiving.
Yeah,
well, they can ban cards, but other than that...
They could ban them, I guess, but how shitty is it to come out with a card and then immediately go, ah,
well,
damn.
Never mind. Yeah. Wipe it.
Take these out of the packs, quick!
Well, especially when it's a very expensive card, which has happened multiple times. That's a whole other conversation. But So coming back around to this complexity versus strategy thing, I think it's very important to get outside of your genre, of your clique of games. If you want to design games, you have to look at that scale of complexity and see everything that's available and think about, like, unless you're just going to be like, all right, I just make war games for war game audiences and that's all I do.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if I agree with what you're saying, because, like, really, I mean, it just depends on the game you're making, you know? It's because, like, I could step out, like, for the game that I'm making, and I could be like, and I've kind of done this a little bit, but and think like, okay, well, how can I make this accessible for like family friendly audiences? You know, the exploding kittens type of like rise in game design that's been really popular lately.
Yeah, I mean, if that's your target audience, right?
Right, but that's the difference, is if that's my target audience. But if their target audience is war gamers that are maybe intimidated by the high end war gaming and need some sort of a gateway drug, Root seems to be perfectly slotted in there.
I'm actually really interested to see the people who are buying and playing Root, and if his analysis of war games need an entry point is true. And I kind of feel like it probably is, in that there needs to be a step between Settlers of Catan and Twilight Imperium. And
yeah.
Root feels like that's the step.
Yeah, I'd say so.
But I think Evan's right, and that's kind of why we all played it, that you can learn things as a designer from games and genres that are outside your comfort zone, and you should, because you can pull a mechanic from anywhere. You can find some chocolate to get on your peanut butter in any genre.
Yeah.
That's the grossest.
You just
for
said
some
chocolate
reason,
and peanut butter
gross
for some reason,
talking about
disgusting.
It with
chocolate on my peanut butter.
Get your peanut butter out of my chocolate.
Oh god. Oh,
so god. What you're saying is Root, exploding kittens, exploding war gaming.
Yeah,
new
exploding
genre.
Root.
Well, actually, I was gonna segue into that. Like, is there a casual game that does the asymmetry of Root? Could you break Root down into an exploding kittens type card?
That's what I'm curious about. I'm curious the level of depth with Root. I think what's weird about it is I do think that yes, not necessarily. It doesn't work this way on a graph. But I do think that, yes, added complexity can in turn add some levels of depth. But there must be some sort of a cutoff point, right? Where, like, if you were looking at a graph that, like, complexity overshadows the depth and people go, like, this isn't fucking worth it. Like, and then they just drop off and they don't really find an interest in the game. But, like, what I'm curious, and we talked about this last night when we were discussing the game, but, like, I'm just fascinated by hearing other designers' standpoints on game designers that design these type of games when, like, all of us across the board do not feel that way when we design our own games. In that, like, what is the complexity cutoff for that, for Cole when he's designing this, or for the designer of Twilight Imperium or designer for Scythe? Like, they have a much different complexity cutoff point, and it's based off of their gaming experience, I think.
Knowing their audience for their genre.
And knowing their audience, because they probably are their audience, which is understandable.
Yeah.
But, like,
and we're ours.
It's such a difference, right? In, like, designing for that complexity, where it's like, I try and think about, if I tried thinking about designing Root, I would have cut 100 things out of there.
They all would have been cats. They would have all been cats doing the same thing that cats do.
Okay, I wouldn't go that far.
We even have arrived at asymmetrical gameplay? I mean, that's
if that was the core, if that was the initial idea, then yes. Right. But
if you're not designing it asymmetrical, it's not Root in any sense. Right. Like, that's the core.
I agree with that.
The thing that the thing that I like about Rue is that each faction, you know, plays completely differently, but it kind of almost draws in different types of players to that faction. Because like if you like playing games and you're doing your own thing, you're the vagabond. If you like spreading, you like building things, crafting things, you're the Marquis. If you like spreading your army and you like thinking four steps ahead, you're the Airy.
Yeah.
And then if you just like insta-killing, I guess insta-killing, like
you like winning.
I haven't played that enough, so I don't know like what the strategy is.
This is one thing I do think that this type of game design, I don't know if it purposefully encourages it. I'm not quite sure. Or if Cole didn't care about this aspect. But one thing I caught myself doing is it encouraged me to not encourage, I didn't care what you guys were doing. I did. I wanted to know, but I also knew that unless I can see what you guys are doing and actually play a turn myself, I just give up. I'm like, I don't know what you're going to be doing. I just know at some point you could do this thing, I guess. Like,
it's too much to process.
There's too much to process. And it's probably just because it was my first game, but like, it definitely kind of shut my brain off. And I was like, if you do that, like, okay, can you tell me how to stop you? Like, because that's the only thing I could think of.
I said exactly that.
Right.
In our game.
Yeah.
Like, hey, Tyler, if I do this, can you please tell me if it will meaningfully impact you in any way?
Right.
I have no idea.
That's not a great thing to ask. Because
you're about to win.
In a game driven on spite and petty, that's not a great thing to have to ask someone that you want to spite.
You're right.
It's a conflict game. Well, that's the thing. It's like, I think in one of the interviews I was watching with Cole, it's like, it's a conflict game. If you don't enjoy, like, if you're not into games that, like, allow you to take pieces, take your opponent's pieces off the board, and in turn them taking pieces off your pieces off the board, then you're probably not going to be your kind of game. It's definitely a conflict game. You're going to be having a lot of conflict, and I like some people like get really salty about that kind of gameplay, and that's just the game. Like if you can't I think Gavin, you're saying something about like, you know, you want to have fun even if you're losing. And like, I mean, there's extents to that. Like,
a design philosophy that I want to talk about, though. That he said in the GDC talk that's sort of a test for whether you are the target audience for this game. But I think our sensibilities as designers for a casual audience is much more like, no, we need to make a game that makes that fun. No matter who you are, we have to get you on board with laughing at your own death. We have to get you on board with laughing at throwing your opponent under the bus and have them laugh too. You know, that feels like more.
I did not have that feeling playing Root.
Really?
I did not. No, I did not have a good feeling when Tyler killed five of my dudes and he lost nothing in return. That felt
well. You're the kid.
You should have. Then don't play war games.
You're the kid, like meticulously stacking blocks, and then he just like.
I've played Warhammer. I play Magic. Like, I'm not necessarily averse to that type of thing. I'm totally fine with playing war games or whatever. The problem I had with it was that I didn't understand what my choice meant. And that's part of the asymmetrical gameplay. Right?
Well, I'd say that's also part of the complexity, though. And that's the complexity problem I'm talking about.
Right.
Yeah.
Is that if you can make choices and not fully understand what those choices mean, I guess that's problematic.
And then you kind of feel cheated because you were like, well, I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah.
And then it's almost at that point, it's kind of like you don't want to play that game anymore. You'd rather restart the game.
Yep. You're checked out for the whole rest of the experience.
And that, I mean, again, it's like this is definitely a game for a specific genre. But what I find interesting is like generally I am a fan of games for what they can accomplish making me feel. It doesn't matter what it is.
Whatever it make you feel.
I mean, I saw what Cole was attempting to do, and my interest is piqued enough to where I want to play another couple of games, right? But it's also strange because I'd say from my own personal experience, like what I really enjoy playing are games that I suppose are more casual and lighthearted. But I can play this game, and I do think that it did succeed in a lot of things that he was trying to accomplish. We're still talking about it on this podcast the next day, discussing that, you know, what we're going to do if we play again.
Well, part of that is also just how intriguing the design is, why we wanted to talk about it. But I guess the question that leads me to as like the big picture question, do we think Root is the best version of itself? Of what it's trying to be.
I don't know if I've played enough of these types of games to answer that question.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever played what was it called again? Kingmaker
style.
Well,
I've never really played too many.
Kingmaking.
Like, specifically designed for that, I guess.
Calling
like,
a game that. A Kingmaker game is usually a derogatory term. It's usually like, oh, this. Oh. Yeah, it's usually like, oh, this game sucks because it's a Kingmaking game, meaning that it has this type of gameplay, but he purposefully designed the game to be that. So.
Right.
See, I don't know. I don't really see it as an insult.
And like, Kingmaking, I don't think is really a genre. It's like, there's Kingmaking aspects to Exploding Kittens. Like,
right. Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. I just call it like a more of a like the philosophy, I guess, behind this, because he used that term as himself in the design of it, I guess.
Okay, question, Tyler.
Yes.
Being a Risk player, how do you think Risk and Root compare?
Ooh, that's a tough one. Honestly, about the same, because it becomes the same. It kind of becomes the same scenario. Where you, if like when one person starts spreading from Australia and like starts taking out, it takes all the smaller guys who start wailing on that particular player. Mm-hmm. And it becomes kind of the same thing. There is one game I played way back when where, I was doing the strat and my friend, he specifically, like, sabotaged my plan. Just he didn't care about his own victory condition. He just tried to screw me over, and I lost. And like he felt good about it. It's kind of it can be the kind of the same scenario. I think like the one thing with Root, I think we talked about it last night. I just kind of want to keep the conversation moving, but is I think we've all agreed that it kind of just ends at 30.
Yeah. It is a little bit of a letdown, and I guess I'm kind of curious. I don't know if he talked much about that in the GDC talk. I feel like he mentioned something about the end of the game.
I remember it. If you want,
yeah, go ahead.
So he discussed that what he didn't like about other war games is that, and we discussed this actually as the alternative, and why we were happy it didn't have that was that they have a count up system, like Takedo and Scythe. They do that, and like. That is a popular thing. I think Wingspan uses it as well. in that at the end of the game, you would count up additional points on top of the points you gained during the game, which are usually done from some bonuses or whatever that you accomplished during playing. And then, oh, maybe you beat the actual winner by 5 points because you did this bonus thing at some point.
Didn't win.
Right. And the reason that I think we all collectively don't like that system is because nothing is more boring and anticlimactic than counting at the end of a game.
Yep. It doesn't feel good. The narrative of your game.
And unless it's the narrative, then great. If it's a game about being an accountant, then great.
No, no, like, no. It contradicts it. Like, the narrative of your game is this guy was in the lead, he did the cool thing, and then everybody counts and someone's like, oh, wait, nope, me. I got it.
Right.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. That.
I definitely don't think that would be the way to go with this. I mean, even if I would just prefer like one last round, like the one last round thing
from Civ.
Yeah, like pretty much like a lot of the games kind of like this usually have like a round of.
I don't know that I've seen a good Euro or War game really solve this. I mean, War games like War Machine do, but where there's very little narrative conclusion. There is a victory track and you get to the top of it and it's not really clear what that means in terms of the story of the game and why it is we're stopping here, you know? And I don't know what I would do to make Root work because it can't be board control. It can't be like everybody controls all the board because the cats start with all of it and the vagabond can't hold anything. So you can't so clearly having this sort of nebulous ending opened up design paths, which made the asymmetry way better. But you're losing something strong in the narrative there.
Right. I think there's not really a climax as part of the problem. I guess he's relying on the players to make their own climax to the story and kind of be like, okay.
And we did.
Yeah, but it still felt sort of anticlimactic where we knew who was going to win and we had a couple more turns where it's like, okay, well, hurry up
and
win.
Let's try to stop him.
Yeah, we're going to try to do what we can to stop him.
Yeah, we all allied to try to stop him and I felt like that was kind of a satisfying act three. Sure. But the story in game of what happened is not concluded. Like, look at that board, it could look just the same in the middle of the game.
It also just kind of feels arbitrary that it's like, okay, you hit 30 points, you win. Like, what is that? It's a very mechanical way of ending a game.
Yeah.
Where it's like, it's just over. Yeah. Like, but on the board, the board still looks the same, but nope, we all stop fighting.
Like, there's other systems, take Small World, for example. It just. I don't really necessarily like the way Small World ends, but it feels more satisfying, I guess, that it's 9 rounds if you have 4 players or 5 players or whatever, and it's like you can count down. It's a countdown system, right, to the end of the game. I've always kind of preferred games that have a victory point or some kind of natural way for the game to end. But it's maybe this is a whole different conversation of how games should end.
Yeah.
So I don't know if we should get too far into that.
Well, so just in Cole's defense, he did mention that the way that he does prefer to design them is that he does believe that if the end is in sight in a game, it should end shortly afterwards at the very least.
Yeah.
I would say that did basically happen with our game is we all had about one more turn. By the time we saw, okay, well, Tyler's probably going to win at this point.
Yeah.
It also didn't help that, it was my first game. We weren't as familiar with the Woodland Alliance. It was first time Kevin played the Vagabond. So I think there was just enough inexperience where I think in a more experienced game, it probably maybe would have felt a little bit more natural.
That's the thing. It's there's lessons learned from this game. Now I imagine Gavin... he's going to be more aware of where the woodland can, take over, sprout up their bases.
I'm going to kill all your sympathy tokens. Every one of them.
The bases are more important to kill.
Listen, Drea is the Woodland Alliance main, okay?
Okay.
I think that was the first time you played it.
That was the first time I played it. And the weird thing is
and you dominated.
Well, so So here's the difference. Is if we played that in real tabletop fashion, I would not have done that well. The only reason I could make the decision is because it was digital.
It was
and things would glow. Yeah, it was kind of telling me the options I had. So I just clicked buttons. And so I didn't actually learn anything by playing other than some of the mechanics.
I do think that's such an interesting point, though, is that we even... it even was a semi-complex game... I'd say in the grand scheme of things, maybe a mid complexity on the digital version, but I can only imagine it's got to be high complexity once you bring it out on the table, because you're right in that, like, imagine looking at a map and not having these glowing indicators saying, like, yeah, you can actually do this. For instance, there is that time I tried building a building, and all of us collectively were like, why can't I build it here? Like, the rules, the effect of this ability is saying I should be able to build this building in this slot. But what it didn't mention, and what none of us knew, was that I had to have adjacent controlled territories.
We would have just done it if we were playing physically.
Exactly.
But the thing is, I don't think that would have ruined it. Like, no. I think we would have thought we were playing correctly, and then next day we would have been like, oh, we missed a rule, and it wouldn't have really changed much.
And that happens every once in a while. Like, any game can have that, honestly. Yeah. Like, there's been plenty of games like that I'm like, oh, we did that completely wrong. Like, me and my friends used to play Pandemic a lot, and we it didn't dawn on us until, like, later on, where we were like, oh, we made that, like, 10,000 times harder for ourselves than it needed. We could never beat it because we kept doing something wrong, and it like would just always destroy us because, like, we were not playing right. So we made it 10,000 times harder. And so things like that, it's kind of like, if you like the game, you'll keep reading the instructions, you'll keep learning more about it.
Maybe. I mean, sometimes. I tend to unless not want to keep reading the instructions.
Unless if you're having fun the way you're playing, then, you know, who cares?
Right, I suppose. And then you find out that, oh, actually, it's a huge advantage if I can build a building anywhere without adjacent spots, and we don't know because we weren't the designer and don't have all that in-depth knowledge of it.
Okay, so
what? But we're also filthy casuals.
How do we all? How do just to kind of start wrapping things up here? How do we all feel about Root? Like, do we think it's a good game? I don't know if I want to necessarily say say definitively whether it's good or not. But I think it's a great. I think it's a very well designed game.
We should probably describe what we consider a good game to be. And for me personally, did it execute on what the designer was trying to accomplish? And I personally think yes.
Yeah.
Like,
okay.
And I'd say there's obviously an audience, whether we are it or not. It's there. It's ranked 32 on Board Game Geek. Sure. Like,
there was 8,000 backers. There was at least 8,000 people the first.
Well, but they hadn't played it at the time.
The expansion was like 20,000.
There you
go.
That
was interesting.
People came back.
But Forrest, you seem to be the most on the fence out of us, and you're saying that seems to be just you don't think you're the audience for it.
Right.
The game
I can separate
its goal.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I can separate myself from you know, whether or not it's actually a good game or not. It's just my main curiosity is can this game's depth exist with less complexity?
I'd love to tease that out.
Try to design it. I challenge
you. Right?
Well, you know what's interesting is I think Small World kind of is a similar thing with less complexity. So
kinda, yeah. Yeah, I can give it that.
Yeah.
I'd actually say Risk is even a less complex version of it.
But does it have the same depth?
I mean, I guess your starting point makes Risk sort of asymmetrical, but not in terms of your mechanics.
Right. I'd say that's the main difference probably.
But Tyler, what are your thoughts on if it's a good game?
I mean, I guess I agree that I think it's exactly what Cole was going for, and it hits the market that he wanted to hit. The other thing that's interesting is, like, for upon the success of it, I think in the interview they brought it up as, like, the art style is a big seller for it as well. But, I mean, I still enjoy playing it. I like that we can keep playing and I can keep learning more things about it, and it's kind of an, like I said earlier, it's kind of an interesting natural replayability rather than just setting up the board differently or just creating new scenarios. There's more to learn about the game, kind of like mastering chess or Go. It's just you're the more you play, the more you start to understand.
That's sort of my biggest hang up on it, like, is the can it have its cake and eat it in that there's a lot of replayability and the depth comes in the replayability. So are you just saying people who can't get a group every week aren't going to enjoy this game and that's it? And that's hard for me to tell, because I like this game in part because I'm excited to play it again from different factions. and try different strategies with the faction that I had and learn my own faction better. All these things are contingent on multiple playthroughs. And if I ask myself, did I have fun in my first two rounds, or am I just hoping that it's going to live up to the game that's in my mind in the next few rounds? I'm not entirely sure. So I'd say I like the depth, and I love that the complexity of the mechanics gives me stuff to latch onto. I do wonder if it could be done less complexly, but I really enjoy it just for what it is.
Well, that's going to do it for this episode of the Distraction Makers Podcast. If you'd like to ask a question or help us test our games, or maybe if you're working on a game of your own, join us over on our Discord channel. You can find the link in the description below. If you're enjoying the show, make sure to give us a 5-star review on whatever platform you're listening to this podcast on, and we will see you next week.
Anything we want to put in here to wrap this up?
Yes. Cards Against Humanity is great.